Cold mornings, frosty windows. Yep, it's that time of year. So treat yourself and start your day with a cup of fresh roasted Sterling Roastery coffee, sourced from around the world and roasted multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. It's the kind of warm-up every sports fan deserves this holiday season. And right now, you can win one of three $50 Sterling gift cards, perfect for gifting or building your own winning lineup of Java in the morning. Enter today at sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways so you can wake up, warm up, and Sterling up this holiday season. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
125 defining moments, one legendary league. This is Darren Hayes of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, and a great book is out right now, NFL Moments, 125 Icons and Stories That Define the NFL. It's a definitive visual history of the National Football League, packed with iconic images and untold stories behind the game's biggest plays and its greatest players. From the early legends like Red Grange to today's stars like Patrick Mahomes, this book is a touchdown for fans who crave more than just stories. So give your football bookshelf a Hall of Fame upgrade or snag a holiday gift for that NFL history buff on your shopping list. Pick up NFL Moments, available now at your favorite bookseller. In this episode, we're about to go back 100 years into the 1920s to one of the great teams in the National Football League, Philadelphia's first champion team, the Frankford Yellow Jackets. Author Brian Michael joins us to tell us all about it.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time.
Welcome to the deep archives of football history. We love to go back in time, talk about some of the great National Football League teams and pro teams and college teams. And today we're going to talk about one that we've really wrote a lot about in our book Maroon that we wrote with Jeffrey Payne just not too long ago. And that's the arch rival of the Pottsville Maroons, the Frankford Yellow Jackets. What an interesting team in the eastern Pennsylvania area, basically a burg of Philadelphia that really had a great impact on National Football League history with some excellent players and a championship. And before we get into the story with our guest, Brian Michael, who wrote a book about it, I'd like you to make sure you can hit that subscribe button. And if you like it, give us a thumbs up, too. That really helps us out with our YouTube so we can bring you more great stories and videos here from Pigskin Dispatch. So without any further ado, let's go on to our interview. Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And welcome to another edition where we get to talk to an author that's wrote a recent book on some great football history. And this is really a fantastic time to have this author on. He has written about the Frankford Yellow Jackets. He is a returning guest, Brian Michael. Welcome back to the Pigpen.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Darren.
Yeah, Brian. How exciting! Your book is out, the long-awaited and long-worked-on piece of art. You know, yeah, very awesome. So, why don't you go ahead and read the title? Let's read the title. Let's let people know that are because some people are listening on the podcast. So.
Sure. So, yeah, Frankford Yellow Jackets, Philadelphia's first NFL team. So, if people didn't know that, it's a great first kind of entry into. Hopefully judging the book by its cover. And we've got the champions, 1926. And of course, myself and co-author Andrew Weicker.
Yeah, very good book. I appreciate you sending me a copy of it. I really enjoyed it. A lot of great history and a lot of great, not only the football history, but just the history of the town, which, you know, many of us that don't live in the area, it was really enjoyable to help you learn about why Frankford is so special and why they love their football team.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a really big part of the team. You know, just like the Green Bay Packers, they were a community owned team, not owned by just one person or company. So that was a really big part of the Yellow Jackets' success and their history throughout their entire existence.
Yeah. So I guess if you don't mind, why don't you start, you know, where did the Frankford team come from?
Sure. Yeah. So the Frankfurt Athletic Association was started in 1899, and they sponsored a football, baseball, rugby team when they first started up in Frankfurt. They played at Worcester Park, which was a big grounds that was owned by an eccentric millionaire who had these animals like camels and llamas and zebras running around. Eventually they turned it into, it was a driving school, but then also the Yellow Jacket Stadium. Back when they first started, the Frankfurt Athletic Association, baseball was by far the biggest sport that they had. It brought in the most money. It had the most games, of course, for baseball. So that was really a big part of the organization, probably for the first 10 years or so. It wasn't until the FAA actually dissolved, reformed a couple years later. It was in 1912. And then football became the dominant sport. And once that happened, they really took off. So again, it's a neighborhood team, just like your neighborhood Boys and Girls Club or rec center, right? It was a local bunch of local guys that were playing football, and they were really good, right? So they were beating teams. They eventually started playing and beating NFL teams. And by 1923, the NFL came knocking and invited them to join the league.
Yeah, it's a really, really a cool story. I mean, think such a thing about that. 1899. I can only think of one other team they still exist and that's been an NFL squad, and that's the Cardinals, who started it, at the end of the 19th century. So that's really special. That's 20 some years before the Packers and the Bears and teams like that were even organized. So pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it was, and we were just talking about recently, just kind of thinking, what if, what if the team was still around and having that long history still going? But unfortunately, they only lasted till 1931. But there's a lot of great stories in between.
Yeah, absolutely. There certainly is. Now, I guess maybe just to clarify, because you have Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, then you have Philadelphia's first team. Why don't you tell us sort of the geographic location of Frankfurt in comparison to where the city of Philadelphia?
Sure. Yeah. So Frankfurt is a neighborhood within Philadelphia. Before the entire city and county were incorporated together, it was its own city with its, own mayor and city council and police force. By the late 1800s, it was added to Philadelphia. But it's centrally located, so great for transportation routes. Great for industry. There was a Frankfurt Arsenal, which was really a big place for jobs. So people lived there, a great working class neighborhood, and a main street too. There was a main street called, of course, Frankfurt Avenue. So that's where all the commerce took place. That's where all the neighbors met, certainly on the weekends. And eventually that's where the Yellow Jackets built their stadium. So you have, a city within the city, Frankfurt neighborhood. It was just on the lower end of Northeast Philadelphia, so just north of the center part of the city. And, like I said, working class, industrial, not far from the distant sawmills, which was huge during the Industrial Revolution as well. So a lot of jobs there, a lot of business and schools, and just what started as neighborhood rivalries. There were different local teams that would play each other, and the games were so interesting that eventually the FAA in 1899 said, hey, let's harness all of our Frankfurtness into one team, right, in one organization. And they did, and they drew on players from those Oxford and Pennant clubs that came before the Yellow Jackets to find their early players, both for baseball and for football. And so, that was really a part of the genesis of the team and the organization, and the community. It was always a fabric of the community, and that was a big part of the Yellow Jackets.
Now, it's interesting that, Frankfurt being a neighborhood in Philadelphia, and at that time in the early 20th century, one of the powerhouses of college football was University of Pennsylvania, the Penn Quakers. Now, was there a lot of Penn Quaker former players that joined on to Frankfurt?
There was. Eventually, after they were reformed in 1912, they started to professionalize a little bit more. So it was fewer players from the neighborhood, more from these big time college programs like Nebraska and Michigan and Penn, of course, and Yale and Harvard. So that came into play, especially the 1919 Penn football team. There were several players, including Heinie Miller, who later became the coach of the Yellow Jackets and of Temple football as well. And, you know, is very well known around early football circles. So that was a big part of it. But even in the early days in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, but Philadelphia specifically, you had the Blue Laws. So that meant the Yellow Jackets were not able to play their games on Sunday. Right. You know, businesses were closed. You couldn't buy alcohol on Sundays. Right. So the Yellow Jackets, whereas most NFL teams, even at the early time, were playing on Sundays, they had to play on Saturdays. But of course, all these big time college football teams were also playing on Saturdays. This was the 1910s and 20s where, like you said, Penn was huge. Penn State, Rutgers, not too far away. Villanova, Lafayette were all really popular teams. So they had to compete with college football teams on Saturday, play their games on Saturday. And then often they would go play a road game on Sunday. So sometimes they would even follow the team that played them at home on Saturday back home on the train, you know, sometimes as far as Chicago, but often New York, Providence, places like that, and play two games in one weekend. And that was unique to the Yellow Jackets. Most early pro football teams played their game on Sunday, and that was it. The Yellow Jackets regularly played two games a week, sometimes even three, especially with Thanksgiving games, which they took on because that was a popular tradition in Philadelphia, high school Thanksgiving games, and they wanted to get in on that, and they played Thanksgiving games. And in the last 5 or 6 years, played the Packers every year on Thanksgiving.
So the tradition of the Packers playing, you're so used to seeing them, you know, play Detroit and things nowadays, but really right. Started, you know, 100 years earlier back the Frankfurt yep. days. Yeah, so many of these are going to sound familiar to our listeners here because it's kind of a unique situation that, you know, we've talked to Greg Tranter, who recently wrote the Providence Steamroller book, and they're great teams from that, you know, mid-1920s era and their championship. Of course, you know, we have our Pottsville book out, and we've talked extensively with that, with Jeff Payne, our co-writer, being on, and some other authors that wrote books on there, and the Yellow Jackets. So these three teams, along with the New York Giants, were sort of that Eastern expansion of the NFL in the mid-1920s, and really were probably the four prominent teams of that you know, of the NFL in the mid-1920s, in the 1924 through 1927-28 era, which is really pretty cool. You have all these brand new teams sprouting up in the NFL and really dominating it. And that definitely the Yellow Jackets were a big part of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you may be able to include Buffalo if you want to East Coast, that's but that's true. Probably more Midwest, but absolutely. The early NFL was, of course, a Midwestern league. So they were always looking to get a foothold in the East Coast where there's more people and more money and more viewers. And they would try to start their own franchises or have, again, a you know, wealthy owner, as we saw with the Maras or with Marshall eventually in D.C. But the Yellow Jackets were unique, again, in that they were a community-based group. And they had so much success against NFL teams before they were in the NFL. Again, this is something you could do back then, just play an NFL team on your schedule. And they were regularly beating them, that they were invited to join the NFL in 1923. So, you know, that was probably a smart move for the league, you know, picking them up, picking up kind of a known quantity and certainly a successful one at that.
Yeah, now many people, you know, just like Pottsville was sort of accused of it in Frankfurt. And just like you said, you're playing these double headers on the weekends and, you know, being sort of, you know, two games at home and have an opponent that's been traveling, you know, to some long line. If you have the Chicago Bears or the Green Bay Packers coming down and playing two games on East Coast, that's kind of a rough weekend. And, you know, but you can also look at it the other way with these teams that are playing, you know, back-to-back games at home. I mean, they're playing two games too many of the times. Like you said, Frankfurt, you know, might be playing at Providence and then coming or playing at home and against somebody and then going to Providence or somebody to pick up a game on Sunday. And so they have to travel and, you know, they're licking their wounds and, you know, having some players or maybe you're missing a game or not up to 100% too.
Interestingly enough, something we came across in our stats as we compiled the game records, you know, most of the Yellow Jackets losses would come on those Sundays after they had played a game already. I think they lost almost half of those games where they played back to back. They still won many more games than they lost. But as we were going through our research, you know, we were looking through newspaper articles, both at the Historical Society of Frankfurt, you know, actually 100-year-old newspaper articles, as well as microfilm at the Pennsylvania Historical Society. And, you know, we were realizing that all of these game stats weren't published anywhere else before. So we put them all together as part of the book. Actually, the publisher said, "It's too much. Your book's getting too big." So we created a website, frankfurtyellowjacketsbook.com, where you can look through all of these game stats, rosters, old photos, history, things like that, that aren't included in the book that we still wanted to get out there to the public because we did all the research. We haven't seen it anywhere else. We are working with profootballreference.com to put some of the pre-NFL stats together. But it's great to find all this stuff and be able to bring it out to the public.
Yeah, it's really cool. And one of the unique things about your book is not only is there the great history in there, but there's the images you have. I don't know how many photos you have in there, but you got to probably have over 100 photos, I'm guessing, in there. And they're just spectacular to look at. And so as you're telling the story of the Frankfurt, the town, it's just it's incredible.
Yeah, there's over 150 photos, and actually it's primarily a photo book. You know, it's the photo history. So there's seven chapters, starting with the neighborhood of Frankfurt, then through the Yellow Jackets, as well as chapters on just players and fans. But each one's full of photos with history captions and it's a fun way to put it together. You can pick up the book at any page, really, and learn a couple things and get some fun stories. That's the thing. There are tons of stories, let alone just the stats, but about the players and how these players would play for multiple teams on the same weekend and things like that. Teams coming and going, players jumping teams. It was really the Wild West of football and learning about the personalities of all these guys was really fascinating.
Yeah, it's really, really cool to see, you know, some of the players that I had researched with Pottsville. And even when I wrote, I wrote a book last year on the 1921 Rose Bowl or Washington and Jefferson. And you have some of those players are playing for Frankfurt. They're also playing for the Pottsville Maroons, you know, from the other side of the state. And it's really, really pretty cool. But I think one of the more intriguing characters that you mentioned and we talked about too, it was a non-player, and that was Shep Royal. What can you tell us a little bit about Shep Royal?
Sure. So Shep was part of the Yellow Jackets probably for over two decades, the last which as the president of the team. So he, you know, was behind a lot of the success of the Yellow Jackets, mostly on the business side and organizing the expansion of the stadium, the sponsorships. Again, the community was a big part of the team, not just with the fans, but with the sponsorships, as well as the construction of the stadium, the lumber, things like that, all came from the neighborhood. So managing the business interests was a big part of having this community organization survive, because it didn't turn a profit. Any profit that it made, it donated back to the neighborhood. So it would donate, for instance, say a coal heater to the Frankford Day Nursery and things like that. So organizing the finances is a pretty heroic endeavor. Him, as well as all the board of directors, were unpaid positions, right? So they did that. And one of his best moves, and maybe worse, was signing Guy Chamberlain to be the coach. And then mysteriously, he had to leave right around the same time that Shep left and Theo Holden became president. So there was some politicking behind the scenes even back then, but he held it together for all of the teens and 20s, and really turned the Yellow Jackets into this NFL, successful NFL franchise that we're learning about today.
Now, didn't even Shep leave? I mean, he dropped it. He was 1925, I think he was at the post, but the 26th season when Frankfurt ended up winning the NFL championship, Shep Royal wasn't in charge of the Yellow Jackets at that point. Isn't that where he sort of stepped
Yeah,
down?
that's where Theo Holden came on board. But yeah, he was always there behind the scenes too. He was still a board member and part of the organization, which is great because we were able to find all of this information at the Historical Society of Frankfurt. We have, roll call from meetings. We have accounting ledgers. We have the notes from the games, baseball and football. And programs too, which even then would look back on previous years and tell stories of previous years and tell stories about players. So having all them preserved at the Historical Society was amazing, and putting the pieces to it really helped with putting the pieces together. But even still, as you know, they don't always fit perfectly, right? You have players, like we said, playing on the same different teams the same weekend. Sometimes with different names too, or partial names that you come up with. And that was a really hard part about putting the book together, as opposed to with our Eagles book that we did before. A lot of that history is out there and can be checked from multiple sources. This Yellow Jacket stuff, was pretty much primary sources only, and whatever we could get our hands on, we were looking for and we looked at. So it was that part was really interesting.
Yeah, it sounds like you had some great people on your side with not only the Historical Society, but you also have a relative of one of the famous players of Frankfurt who
Sure.
did the foreword, and one of my favorite people and such a great preservationist of early pro football, and that's Mike Moran, and of course his father being Hat Moran, who played one of the teams he played on was the Yellow Jackets, so
Yes.
it's very interesting. So why don't you tell us? I mean, if you
It's
can.
right there. There's
Yeah.
Hammering.
Oh, yeah. So,
Very distinct,
so
looking guy.
yeah. And Mike, has a really great collection of things, not only associated with his father, but a lot from, the Giants when he played there and things like that. So I'm sure he was
A great
a
website too.
source.
Yeah, check out his
Yeah.
website.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
HatMoran.org, if I remember
Yep.
correctly, right? Yeah. Yeah, very, very cool. So, why don't you tell us? You mentioned a couple of the famous players, not named Hat Moran for
Sure.
playing for that. So, why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the players that played for Frankfurt?
Sure. We had Link Lyman was one. He was Hall of Famer from Nebraska. He was probably a little more famous with the Bears. And that's something you find with a lot of these Yellow Jacket players. They were maybe more famous with another team. Hat Moran, again, with the Giants, like you said. For the 1926 championship team, an integral player was Houston Stockton, grandfather of NBA Hall of Famer John Stockton, both Gonzaga graduates. So he was a big part of that team, too. We have Two-Bits Homan. Two-Bits was one of the smallest players ever to play football. He was 5'5", and also credited for inventing the touchdown dance. He, after scoring a touchdown, he held the ball, went over to a teammate, shook his hand, and shook the official's hand, and handed the official the ball, all before returning back to his team. Whereas before, you would just drop to the ground like a rugby try. He gets credit for inventing the touchdown dance. I mentioned Guy Chamberlain. He came over as a previous coach from the Cleveland Bulldogs, Canton Bulldogs, and he had won 3 championships already. So when he came over in 25, he really professionalized the team and, you know, was a big part of that 1926 championship. And he would probably get a lot of credit for that, his veteran leadership on the field and just organization in general. So Guy Chamberlain, pretty famous as well. Hall of Famer.
Pretty incredible run he had. You sit there and think about, what was it, from 1921 through 26? Mm-hmm. He only missed 1 year of not being on a team that won a championship, I think. Yeah. It was something like that.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. He's like the Yogi Bear of, right. Of early football. So, yeah, he was big. Lud Ray, we had mentioned the early 1919 Penn team. Lud Ray, he was later the Eagles coach. First head coach, but he was on the Yellow Jackets as well. And it's great. We have a lot of these player profiles on the website. We have a list of all the players that have played, but we also have some select biographies listed as well. But since we've had the site up, we've been getting some emails from people who say their grandfather or their uncle has played, and we're starting to collect more and more stories on all these players. So there are plenty that aren't just in the Hall of Fame, right? But they all have interesting stories. There was one, Dr. Joe Alexander, who was a doctor up in New York City and would come down on the weekends and play for the Yellow Jackets and probably play for the Maroons and a couple other teams. And he would go back and forth between being a doctor and that. Ray Crowther, who was the captain of the team. He was a boxer, I think, in the Olympics, too. But he invented the tackling sled that we all see throughout OTAs and summer camps and stuff. So he invented the tackling sled. Again, early football days. This was, 3 yards in a cloud of dust type football before we really got things going, you know, like we do today. But these guys were playing just for fun, usually for $10, maybe $50 a game. By the 20s, some of the better players were making maybe $100 or $200 a game. But interestingly enough, for road games, all the players only would make 60% of their home wages. So you actually got paid less for the road games too. So that's what you were working with. Most of the players had jobs in the city or in other cities. And this was for the love of the game, basically.
Yeah, I always find it interesting the pay of professional football. You know, of course, it starts with Pudge Heffelfinger. I think he made $250 his first game, and it sort of went downhill, you know, down to like the $10 mark at some points, you know, 20, 30 years after that. And now, you know, God, the guys are, you know, on the verge of being billionaires, you know, by the time their
careers
are done. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was a lot different game back then. You have some of the same teams, as we've mentioned, same franchises still around. So it's amazing that they've stuck around for so long. But it was certainly a different game back in those days.
Yeah, fascinating book, folks. I mean, I highly recommend it. You know, especially, you know, you listen to this show, we're back in that era, the 1920s, quite a bit, and in pro football. And you know, Brian and his co-author, and you know, everybody else that's contributed, has really poured their heart and love of football into this book, and it really shows. And it's a great thing. It was long awaited. I was hearing rumors of it for a long time, and I know we touched base on it a couple of times. Actually, we had Brian on probably what, 4 or 5 years ago, talking about Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, and we were doing a series on early football. So it got some of the rudimentary parts of your research, I'm sure, on there. So.
Yes, it has been a process. It started with our Eagles book when we were looking for pre-Eagles history and photos, and we went over to the Historical Society of Frankfurt. We were only looking for maybe 4 or 5 photos, and we found hundreds, as well as all these other things that I mentioned. So we filed it away. We knew that it was there, and that once we were done with our Eagles book, we would come back to it. And like you said, here we are. So we're very excited. It's 2025 now, but next year will be the 100th anniversary of their NFL championship. So we're even more excited for next year, having the book out and getting to do some events and maybe some cool things for the Yellow Jackets then.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I think I would be remiss if I didn't let you give the spiel. You know, you're wearing the shirt, of course, that I'm sure people are sitting there going, hey, where can I get one of those shirts? And I think you have some information on maybe where folks can get a copy of the shirt.
Sure. Yeah. So shibesports.com, as in Shibe Park. Shy Vintage Sports is a local apparel store that I own in Center City, Philadelphia. We specialize in old school, you know, Philly sports teams area, Philly history, and the Yellow Jackets are certainly one of them. You know, we don't sell a ton of Yellow Jackets shirts, certainly compared to our Kelly Green Eagles gear, but it's these kind of stories that we like to make sure that are out there in the public, because otherwise they might get forgotten, and it's really a part of, you know, the city and the city history. And, you know, I mentioned the game of football was different back then, but the fans in Philly were very much the same, very passionate, went to all the home games. They tailgated. Yellow Jacket Stadium had a big parking lot with a lot of outhouses in there. And they traveled well. They would charter their own trains to Atlantic City, to New York, and bring thousands of people. So much so that almost all the newspapers in those cities would mention that in the game recap, just how many Yellow Jackets fans were there. They would parade from their hotel to the stadium. It was always a big deal. So some things like that, the Philly fandom never changes.
Yeah, it's amazing when you read some of those old excerpts from newspapers, like especially like Atlantic City with the Roses when they would entertain and play Frankfurt or play Pottsville. And it seems like there was a parade before the game, like you said, and fanfare and the mayor, you know, speaking before the crowd. It's really, really quite a spectacle. It's something that we don't even see today. You know, it's kind of neat.
Right. It really was. And the Yellow Jackets, Rosies, Atlantic City Rosies rivalry was always a big one. They would usually play in the beginning of the year, every year, probably while it was still nice and warm down in Atlantic City. So they regularly played locally. Holmesburg was a big rival. Again, you would have the mayor come out for that one, which was, you know, basically the next neighborhood up, maybe two up, in Northeast Philly. And then later the Packers and the Bears. The Bears were the real tough team that the Yellow Jackets could just never beat. Right. That was, they were always standing in their way. But then finally in 1926, in front of a big crowd at Shibe Park, not their usual stadium, they went to the big, you know, NFL Philadelphia A's stadium, and they beat them finally. So that was, you know, a big step on the way to their championship.
Yeah, very, very cool. Well, Brian, we really appreciate you preserving this history of the, you know, the team, of the NFL history, of, you know, early professional history with everything that you've done and collected in this book. And maybe let's mention the name of the book again, where folks can get it. And we'll also, folks, don't worry if you're driving or something, we'll put links that Brian is mentioning here so you can check in the show notes of YouTube or of the podcast. So go ahead, Brian. I'm sorry.
Sure. Yep. It's Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, Philadelphia's first NFL team. And you could get it at Frankfurt Yellow Jackets book. com. You could Google that, but check out the website too. We love to get people's feedback. Certainly, if you have any stories that you remember, we're just really just trying to collect history here, both with the book and the website.
Very cool. We appreciate you coming on and for sharing your book with us and sending you know, some shirts up our way earlier this year too with the pot, because he also has Pottsville shirts at his store too, which is really cool too, along with some other really neat teams. You know, I noticed you had was it the World Football League team, you know, with Philadelphia Stars, I think I saw on there, and some other defunct teams of other sports too, which are really pretty neat to see. So great job.
Yeah, thank you, Darren. Thank you.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
You did not see their faces on the Wheaties boxes, nor did they have the headlines, but they were breaking barriers, one pitch at a time. The integration of minor league baseball, a history and player register, 1946 to 1959, by Rick Swain and Gary C. Fink, shines a light on the overlooked heroes who paved the way for future legends. From dusty bus rides to hostile crowds, these players fought for a place in a game that did not want to see them win. More than history, it's a tribute to courage, perseverance, and the power of a game to change. Honor their legacy today and grab a copy of The Integration of Minor League Baseball at your favorite bookseller.